Welcome to another edition of Beyond the Classroom. I'm your host, David Schoenfeld. This program is produced by WWUH Radio, a community service of the University of Hartford. You may hear it in Connecticut on the stations of WWUH West Hartford, WAPJ Torrington, WDJW Summers, and WWEB Wallingford. Join me as members of the faculty and staff of the University of Hartford share information about their wide-ranging research activities and about their work on behalf of the university and the community at large. My guest today is Dr. John Feierabend, professor of music and the director of the Music Education Division at the Hart School of Music of the University of Hartford. I recorded this conversation on January 6, 2014. What follows is the second and concluding part of that interview. Now, you've anticipated my very next question very conveniently. I was going to ask you about what you call conversational solfège. What do you mean by that? And can you maybe give us some examples?
Sure. Conversational solfège, as I said, was rooted in a Kodály approach. I was trained with a Kodály certificate, and I teach in some summer Kodály programs still. But along the way, as I was adapting the idea of using American folk songs instead of Hungarian folk songs, my organization came differently. First of all, in Hungary, there, if you analyze the folk music, you won't find much folk music in meter 6/8, in what we call compound meter. It's not in their language. It's not in their poetry. It's not in their folk songs. They are downbeat language. Most of their music is in 2/4 or possibly 3/4. And so when they're introducing the idea of music notation in Hungary, 6/8 is taught very late as a strange thing other countries do. Now, when you have to adapt it for our country, you have to make that change. Our primary poetic meter in the United States is iambic pentameter, which is 6/8 meter with an eighth note upbeat. So it's reflected in our language. It's almost impossible to start a sentence without an eighth note upbeat. Just try. Almost all sentences begin with eighth note upbeats. The only time they don't begin with upbeats is when you're scolding somebody. Stop it. It begins with a downbeat. So the idea of eighth note upbeat and 6/8 was part of my restructuring of what was done in Hungary so that it seemed more appropriate for the rhythmic patterns of the United States, and I included that in this conversational solfège method.
So I'm just thinking of an example. I went to school the other day. My teacher came in late.
It's almost impossible to begin a sentence without an eighth note upbeat, and we are this sort of skipping language. We Humpty Dumpty sat on the wall. Jack be nimble, Jack be quick. Oats be beans and barley grow. We have this sort of skippiness to us.
But those don't have upbeats.
Those particular ones do not have upbeats. But mostly, happy birthday to, it starts with an eighth note upbeat. We sort of always have a little article before our primary word, and that becomes an upbeat. It becomes an upbeat. So it's just our language. So conversational solfège was, for me, an opportunity to restructure what we taught rhythmically in a different order than the Hungarians. But it also was an opportunity for me to restructure melodies in the way that Hungary was taught. Hungary is in a strange place in the world. It's where East meets West. We call it Eastern European. And there was 1,000 years where the Mongolians were in that part of the world. And being an Asian culture, Mongolians had what we know as pentatonic music as their folk music. And it left behind in Hungary an influence, a pentatonic influence. And so much of the Kodály approach in Hungary is strongly based on studying pentatonic melodies and pentatonic patterns before they learn major and minor diatonic melodies. That has to be adjusted for our country as well. While we do have songs that use the five pentatonic tones, they aren't truly pentatonic melodies. A pentatonic melody, as I learned by teaching in China, pentatonic melodies do not have what we call a resting tone or a feeling of closure at the end of the song. If I were to sing in pentatonic, it would sound something like re do la so la do re mi so mi re re do re mi re do la so mi re so la so re mi so la re. And I would ask, where should I stop? And you would say, I don't know. That's pentatonic. Pentatonic has a vagueness about it. It's very Asian sounding. We don't like that in our country. When the music comes to an end, if I said, sol, la, sol, fa, mi, re, you want to hear do, because that's our country. We are tonally based. Western music, classical music, Western folk music, all the countries in Western Europe and the United States are based on tonality, which means we are based on the feeling of finality on the last note. So as I made my adaptation for conversational solfège from the Kodály approach, I not only had to make rhythmic considerations that made how are we different from Hungary, but also melodic considerations. How are our folk song melodies different from the melodies in Hungary? And then finally, the pedagogy, which is where the word conversational solfège comes from. In the Kodály approach, as you are learning notation at more and more advanced levels, students were learning by both their ear and their eye almost simultaneously. So you would be shown a piece of notation and told, this is what it sounds like. But I got my inspiration from foreign language programs where students would learn the foreign language by ear first. So conversational French, conversational Russian, conversational German. I listen to conversational German CDs in my car, and I can speak fairly good German. I don't really know how to read much German. I suppose I could learn to read it if I wanted to. It also seems like a natural learning process, even in our own language. We spoke thousands of words before we were 5 years old. And then one day you came to school and someone said, by the way, there's a way you can see language. It's called the alphabet. So the idea that we would have a language first and then be taught, and this is what it looks like, I wanted to do the same thing for music, that there can be a language for rhythms and tones called rhythm syllables or solfège syllables, where I can identify the melody or the rhythm that you're hearing and give labels to it by ear. And then once the students have learned to correctly identify it by ear, I say, and by the way, there's a way you can see that. It's called notation. So conversational solfège is a program where I've organized different stages of learning. It's actually a 12-step program. So in the process, the students go through 12 different challenges. And by the time they are at challenge number 12, or the 12th level of challenge, that level is called composition. And so students, by that point, will have learned both to recognize sounds by ear, how to read them, this is what they look like, and also how to write them. So if they have an original music idea, they will be able to successfully write it down without using an instrument. They'll know how to make notation out of a musical thought that's in their brain. And so conversational solfège takes simple rhythms through the 12 steps, it takes simple melodies through the 12 steps, and then it adds harder rhythms and harder melodies. And after years, if you choose to stick with it for a few years, a person would be able to write down musical thoughts the same way they would be able to write an essay on how I spent my summer vacation. They'd be able to write down any musical thought that came into their head with hopefully the same ease that they could write a sentence.
12-step approach. So what would be some of the first steps?
They're divided into four categories. So step number one is just experiencing a song. And the point of step number one, experiencing a song, is so that a song becomes familiar to a child or a student. In step number one, you might just be singing hot cross buns, one a penny, two a penny, hot cross buns. That would be step one. Steps two through five are the ear labeling steps. So I won't tell you each one specifically, but during these steps, you still are not seeing anything. It's all training the student to listen carefully. And so at some point, by the time you're in step three, a student would be able to use the do, re, mi words and say, mi, re, do, 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 re, 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 mi, re, do. Step five, the final ear step, means that students have arrived at a point where they can still use these syllables, do, re, mi, but create an original idea. So I might sing something to them and say, listen to this. I'm going to sing something. Mi, mi, re, re, mi, re, do, 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 re, re, mi, mi. Now, can you make up something different than that? And end on do. And so a child might go, do, do, re, re, do, do, mi, 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 re, re, mi, re, do. Well, that child just improvised and made up a tune. And because they're using the solfège syllables, the do, re, mi's, I will be able now to go to step six. And my step six through eight are the steps where I say, and this is what it looks like. So when they just improvised with Do, Re, Mi, they didn't even know that there was a way they could see it. They only knew there was a way that they could label the sounds that they're hearing. At steps six through eight, I say, and this is what Do, Re, Mi looks like. And of course, because I'm using a system called movable Do, Re, Mi will live in different places on the staff depending on what key they're in. And I make the analogy, it's like an apartment building, that there are different apartments. There's an A apartment and a B apartment and a C apartment. And Do, Re, Mi might be living in the F apartment and the G apartment and the A apartment in this hotel or this apartment building. But when they go to visit in the summertime to another apartment building, it's the same people, but they're living in different apartments. And that's the same analogy as that pitches can be in different tones. The first note of the scale could be any pitch. It could be an F if it's the key of F, or G if it's the key of G. And Do can live in the F apartment if it's in this apartment building, but Do could also live in the G apartment if it's in this apartment building. And so the people don't change, Do, Re, Mi, but where they live in the apartment building changes as we show the children how Do, Re, Mi can live in different keys. The last steps, 9 through 12, are when the students learn to use pencil and paper and write down their musical thoughts. So in this one, final step 12, composition, they will have learned how to make Do, Re, Mi on a staff with a pencil and paper. And now what they can sing for me, like that child just made up a little tune with Do, Re, Mi, I'd say, now write it down. And so the Do, Re, Mi's enable the child to write it down correctly because the syllables, Do, Re, Mi, tell the student what to write. If the child just made up a tune, bum, 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 and I said, write it down, it's difficult to figure out how, what notes are those and how can I write it down? But if they have the solfege syllable, conversationally, conversational solfege, to go, mi, mi, re, re, mi, mi, do, 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 re, re, do, the syllables tell them what to write. And so they know, oh, Do lives here. I just sang Do. What did you sing next? Re? We'll write a Re. What did you sing next? Mi. We'll write a Mi. So once they learn where the notes are on the staff in steps 6 through 8, then it's a very simple procedure for them to now write down when they sing in solfege, to write down the notation, and that's in steps 9 through 12.
My guest today is Dr. John Feierabend, professor of music and the director of the Music Education Division at the Hart School of Music of the University of Hartford. Let's get to the big question here. Why should children study music? Why should they learn all this? Why is it important? I'm going to throw out little questions that you can then deal with in whichever way you please. But in this age where we're cutting back on almost everything, make the case for music in the elementary school. Why should young people learn this if they're obviously not going to go on and become professional musicians? How will it help them in their lives?
Philosophically, I tackled this one a while back. I had to. As a young teacher, it seemed that the purpose for elementary music was to prepare students to go on to be in band, orchestra, and choir. But then when you realize that less than 10% of the children will go on to band, orchestra, and choir, you reassess, why am I doing what I'm doing in the elementary school? 90% of them, I'm spinning my wheels. Why am I teaching them how to be in band, orchestra, and choir? They're never going to be in band, orchestra, and choir. What is it that I'm doing in the elementary school for the other 90% that's going to be valuable for them in their lives? So I came up with the idea that we should look 30 years down the road and come up with a 30-year plan. What are we doing in the elementary school for children that will help them have richer, better lives when they're 30 years old? So I came up with three words. There are three goals in an elementary school program: to help all of the children become tuneful, beatful — I made up that word, but if you can be tuneful, why can't you be beatful? — and the third one, artful. So the three goals, in my opinion, in my books, in my pedagogy books, I speak about these as the three primary goals in an elementary school: helping the children become tuneful, beatful, and artful. And then 30 years from now, what would the outcomes be? So I'll take each of them one at a time. If I succeed in helping a student become tuneful — and there's two parts to that, because we have to be able to process tune in your mind. Some people process tune clearer than other people in their mind. And then I'm also hoping to teach them how to use their voice so they can connect to the tune that's in their mind and they can reproduce it with their voice. So in the elementary school, I want them to become able to sing. What does that mean 30 years from now? It means they can be part of a community, that they can connect with other people through voice. If a person goes on in later in life to worship with a group of people, community singing is a part of worship. And we all know people in a worship setting that do not sing very well. And are they really fully participating? Are they getting out of it what everybody else in the place is getting out of it? We use singing together, the community spirit of singing together, lots of times at a funeral. People are going to share the feeling of suffering by singing Amazing Grace. We are just coming out of the holiday season, and people share memories of intergenerations singing the same traditional songs at holiday time. whether they're Hanukkah songs or they're Passover songs or they're Christmas songs. They're songs that we have sung our whole lives. And when we sing them, we remember when Grandma and Grandpa were still alive. And we're singing them and sharing them with our children, thinking that someday we won't be there, but they will remember us when they sing these songs. There's a valuable building of community when we sing together. After 9/11, we all sang God Bless America. It helped us heal to know that we were singing together. We were unified. We were suffering together. And this song helped us as a community heal. There are smaller ones as well. I think 30 years from now, these children I'm teaching, 30 years from now, they might be parents, and I'm hoping every one of them can sing lullabies to their babies. I'm hoping that they can sing and comfort their child with a song, that they at night can sing their child to sleep. We have the center here where parents bring their children from birth to five each week for classes, and we're teaching the parents activities they can be doing with their babies. And it's sad that a lot of those parents cannot sing very well. And so their child is growing up in a home where there is a parent that doesn't sing well, and it's going to affect that child's own personal musical development, not having had a singing home in the first 5 years. So when I'm teaching today's children, I'm thinking of them when they will be parents 30 years from now, and I'm hoping that they will be parents that can sing and connect to their children through song. 30 years from now, I want them to be able to sing Happy Birthday to their children without their children saying, "Don't sing, Dad." So I think I have that's just the tuneful part. So in an elementary school, I think it's vital that I help all of these children become tuneful so they can be part of a community that connects through voice singing. Beatful. I use the word beatful almost tongue-in-cheek. As I said, I made up the word. And it's really deeper than beatful. It's metric. But I just call it beatful. What I mean by metric is there is no music in the world that is just a bunch of ones, the beat. One, 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 one. Music groups beats in either twos or threes. So one of my goals in an elementary school is to help children be able to feel a beat and that also be able to feel that beats come in groups of twos and threes. So 30 years from now, they get married and they play a waltz for the bride and groom to dance, and the bride and groom may not have had good experiences in elementary school, so they don't feel the group of three that a waltz demands, and they get up and dance one, 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 and you just wonder, gee, why can't that bride and groom feel the three? Because someone didn't teach them to feel the three in an elementary school. Just as singing together builds community, dancing together builds community. Whether it's two people that are dancing together or it's a whole village of folk dancers dancing together, it's something that European countries are doing a much better job at than we are. There's a long tradition of folk dancing in most countries, and it's coming back in this country. You're seeing more and more places you can go country dancing or do international folk dancing. And I think you're seeing that people are missing the community of people dancing together. And it feels so good after an hour or two of being in a group and moving on the beat with each person. You leave at the end of the evening enriched. You feel, I'm not isolated. I'm not just a person with my apps and my video game, isolated in this own little world, but I actually touched people, and we held hands, and we moved together. And I want all of these children in my elementary classrooms 30 years from now to have access to that. So I have to be sure that before I say goodbye to them in fifth or sixth grade, I've helped them all succeed at being able to find the beat in music and be comfortable taking hands with other people and dancing together with other people and being aware of music being in groups of twos or threes so that they can move in sync with other people in twos and threes the way they would. Artful. So the third word, my goal in elementary school, is to help make sure all of these people become artful. What that means is I want children to know when they listen to music, they will feel something. Plato called it below the surface, that they would have an experience not just hearing tune and hearing beat, but they would feel something while they heard the tune or felt the beat. You know, when Plato first talked about the arts, he said, we perceive the world with our senses. We hear the world, we smell the world, we taste, feel, touch the world. And he said, sometimes when you're experiencing the world with your senses, you have an emotional response below the surface. So Plato coined this phrase, below the surface. And he said, this is an artistic response. And that not all things provoke artistic responses, but we want people to be sensitive to those feelings that art can evoke. So I'm just the music teacher, so I'm primarily focusing on the aural art of music and helping students discover that when they hear music, they can be exhilarated, they can feel beauty, they can feel a sadness. All of these are feelings that music can evoke from people. And the community, again, comes into this. Because it's one thing to listen to music on the radio in the car and have a response to the music yourself. And it's another thing to be in a concert hall with 1,000 other people. And the electricity that you often hear about, the electricity in the air, it's real. When a person has an emotional response in a concert hall to a piece of music they're hearing, it's contagious. The person sitting next to them feels not just from themselves, but they feel it from the people around them. Daniel Goldman, author, wrote Social Intelligence, and in that book he talks about this. He says, we are wired to connect emotionally, and emotions are contagious. And I think that's what happens in a concert hall. The emotions are contagious. So, you know, somebody next to you starts giggling, you start giggling. Someone shouts at you, you shout back. So someone in a concert hall feels an emotional response to music, you catch it. It's bigger than just hearing it by yourself in the car. So I want people to have access to that. And if I can teach them in an elementary school how pleasurable it is to react emotionally to music, they might seek that out when they're 30 years old. Maybe they'll want to go find places where they can hear music live with other people. So, you know, we hear from symphony orchestra halls. I was a consultant for the Pittsburgh Symphony, and the conductor told us that the subscriber rate at the Pittsburgh Symphony goes down 2% every year. And he said, we don't have to be rocket scientists to see where we're going to be in 20 years. And so it was very insightful of him that what needs to happen is, how do we bring people back to the audience in the concert hall? And maybe that is one of our important jobs as an elementary teacher, is to teach children that listening to music is a very satisfying experience, and that when they are adults, they might seek out places where they can continue to have those very satisfying experiences, perhaps the concert hall.
Well, that's a very comprehensive and eloquent answer to my question. Now, suppose even that doesn't persuade your audience, your listener, or the
administrator.
the congressional committee that's allocating budgets. What does a music education in the early years do for brain development that will then have ramifications in later life, apart from music?
You will get a different answer to that depending on who you ask. Some of my colleagues would tell you that there are definite benefits in the other types of intelligence to studying music. And I would agree in that how the music is taught would possibly have what I call a side effect on other intelligences. But the idea that music makes you smarter, if you study music, you're going to have better math scores and better reading scores, I don't buy into. It would depend on how you teach the music. I suppose if you taught music as a reading intensive system, you're going to train the brain to read better. If you taught music as a spatially intensive system, recognizing spatial relationships on a piano keyboard, you probably wouldn't develop the spatial area of the brain a little better. But the way that I teach music is not geared toward helping other areas of the brain develop. It's helping the area of the brain that processes music. And by music, I'd like to emphasize that I make a distinction between when you can see it and when you can hear it. In European countries, they make this distinction. Again, we don't do such a good job of it in our country. In European countries, I just came back from Belgium, when they speak about music, you cannot see music. The word music means I hear it. Music is an aural phenomena. You can only hear music. If you're looking at something, they call it notation. You can make music from notation, but notation is not music. So when I'm talking about music education, I'm talking about the word music. I'm talking about the aural development in a person, which is not going to benefit their spatial intelligence or their reading intelligence or their math intelligence. I guess if I went into the theory of music and started talking about a dot equals one half the value of the note added to the note and a time signature is based on these fractions, well, then I guess I'm talking math. But that's not music. That's the theory of music, or it's the theory of notation. So does music make you smarter? I think pretty much that research has been debunked. I think it's how the music was taught that might have stimulated the brain in other areas. But if you're teaching music for the aural development in a brain, then you're just developing that intelligence, the music intelligence in an individual.
But that's reason enough for us to support the teaching
of
music in the schools.
Our campus has this elementary school, the University of Hartford Magnet School, and it's based on the work of a Harvard professor, Howard Gardner. Howard Gardner came up with this idea of multiple intelligences, that we are not just variations of one intelligence, but we have a portfolio of eight intelligences. And the best way to understand that is that most of us that went off to college took either the ACT or the SAT test, and we got a math score and a verbal score, and they weren't the same. Most of us did better in one than the other. Sure, some of us do fine in both or not so well in either, but usually one's better than the other, which tells you that you have a stronger intelligence for one of them than the other. Just because you're good at math doesn't mean you're going to be good at words. Just because you're good at words doesn't mean you're going to be good at math. So Gardner starts there by saying those two intelligences are called linguistic and logical mathematical intelligences. And just because you're good at one and how you develop one doesn't mean you're going to develop the other in the same manner. Well, the good news is the third intelligence he mentions is music intelligence. And just because you're good at math and words doesn't mean you're going to be tuneful, beatful, and artful. Tuneful, beatful, and artful are musical processes that go on in your brain. It's a separate intelligence and a valuable intelligence. His other intelligence is spatial intelligence, bodily kinesthetic, interpersonal, intrapersonal, and naturalistic. Round out a full human being. And the point of the University of Hartford Magnet School is that students are being instructed to use all eight of their intelligences. And to neglect any of them is to neglect a vital part of what it means to be a complete person. Music is an intelligence, and it needs to be developed in all people, or you're missing a vital part of being a complete person. One of the most exciting things that's happened to me in the last year is that a group of teachers from around the United States came together and said, we want to continue promoting your ideas, both conversational solfege and your work in early childhood and elementary school. And they created a new organization called the Fire Robind Association for Music Education. It now has a website. It's going to have its first national conference this coming summer. There will be people that will be making presentations and demonstrations with children, talking about how they have put in place the ideas that I've developed over the last three decades. And it's a very gratifying experience to come to this point in your life and say that your ideas have been widely embraced, and now even an organization has been formed. So after I'm dead and gone, the ideas that I have promoted have been valued and will be perpetuated by many generations yet to come.
Well, that's a remarkable distinction. John, thank you so much for coming in and talking with me today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
This has been the second and concluding part of an interview I conducted on January 6th, 2014, with Professor John Feyerabend, Director of the Music Education Division at the Hart School of Music of the University of Hartford. Beyond the Classroom airs weekly at this time on the stations of WWUH West Hartford, WAPJ Torrington, WDJW Summers, and WWEB Wallingford. WWUH Radio broadcasts as a service of the University of Hartford, locally at 91.3 FM and worldwide at wwuh.org. For more information on this program, visit wwuh.org and search on Beyond the Classroom. To listen to this program again, or to podcasts of any others in this series, please visit hartford.edu/news/podcasts. I'm your host, David Schoenfeld, thanking you for listening and hoping you'll join me for the next edition of Beyond the Classroom.